All right, let's get back to work here. How are we doing? Graham made it most of the way through book three? Halfway?
Maybe
half. Halfway through book three? What did we learn last time? You gotta fill me in here. Make Graham feel like he taught you something. Moderation's kind of important. What did you guys talk about last time? Imitation is a fragmentation of the soul. What does that mean, Chelsea?
I don't know if that's what I wrote.
You wrote it down, and now it must be true because it's in your notebook.
Yeah.
You're
going against what you're meant to do, really. Because you're supposed to have one task for the person. So if you're imitating, you're being something that you're not meant to be.
Yeah.
It steps you outside of your specialization.
Well, what if your specialization is being an imitator?
Well, then you're not going to. If you imitate only one thing, you're best suited for that thing. You're lacking completeness of your knowledge.
But aren't you? If you're an imitator, isn't that something to be? This guy is a carpenter, and this guy is an imitator. This guy makes bookshelves, and this guy gets up on stage and makes animal noises. That's one of the imitators he talks about, right? Somebody who makes animal noises, makes sounds like thunder.
But then
you gotta give him a break. None of them had iPods. they were desperate. They didn't have cable. What is it about imitation that's so puzzling? Yeah.
Well, Plato talks a lot about specialization and. It's implied, or he says that it's supposed to be for what you're naturally your predisposition, whatever, to do that specific thing. So I guess if you're imitating someone that was not truly what you're naturally inclined to do, then you would have that thing that you were inclined to do naturally, and this thing that you're doing on the side, which fragments the soul.
What if what you're naturally inclined to do is be an imitator? And what do we mean by an imitator?
Then I think you'd be true to yourself, but then you wouldn't really be imitating.
Well, why not?
You would just be.
But what is it?
Making animal noises on the stage is what you're inclined to.
What is an imitator? It's a performer, right? An actor. We call them actors. Maybe that's somebody's job. What's wrong with that? Yeah?
Nothing. You should just specialize in what you act. So when you're an actor in comedy, you should stay in the actor comedies and actor tragedies, the same tragedies, because it's possible to play any role as well.
Yeah, well, he says here that the person who's a good comedic actor is not a good tragic actor. Maybe that's true. In other places, he says the opposite. But even somebody who is just a comedic actor, what's wrong with an imitation? Why can you never be an imitator? It doesn't seem like it, and Socrates rarely clues us in to the fact that what he's really doing is metaphysics. But what he's doing here is metaphysics. And this is the first mention of imitation, which is a concept that is central to Plato's metaphysics. And the thing about an imitation that's so strange is that it isn't what it is. Why is that? At least, right? What am I talking about here? An imitation isn't what it is. What does that mean?
I mean, that's the definition of imitation, right? Like, you're being something you're not. So, my argument is going to be that you can't have imitating and stuff like that, because it would teach other people that that's appropriate. Like, that would bring that into your society or public, and that's just bad news.
What's wrong with being an imitation?
Yeah. If you're the guy who stands up on stage imitating animal noises, aren't you then a person? Instead of being an imitator, aren't you a person who makes animal noises? I mean, if you're an imitator, are you really ever an imitator? Don't you just become what you're imitating?
What is that? It requires the knowledge to do that.
I mean, aren't you just essentially the guy who makes animal noises then?
Yeah, you're lying to people. You're portraying yourself. You're giving people these false impressions and giving them false. And so they think that's what a lion sounds like. That's not what an actual lion sounds like. You actually have to have that knowledge.
No. Lying is not necessarily bad, right? Sometimes lying is good for Plato, right? So an imitation is a type of lie. That's true. Because you're saying you're something that you're not. Yeah? Did you ever hear that? We've moved on. To be an imitation is not to be what you are. And it's really just that simple. Every person in the state has a nature. But the imitator doesn't have a nature. Because their nature is to be something that they're not. And if that's the case, if an imitation is not what it is, then an imitation doesn't have a nature. And if we're going to have imitation in our state at all, if we have to have imitation in our state, and we're going to have it a little bit, we want as little of it as possible. We just want it if it will help us develop our citizens into their natures. And it might serve to do that. For example, when you learn how to become a carpenter, you go hang out with the carpenter. Joe, I think you might have started to say this. You go hang out with the carpenter and you imitate what they're doing as a way to become like them. But you don't imitate what they're doing to become an imitator. That's the worst case scenario, because then you never really become anything.
So are you saying that there are imitators, that their job is to shape the people of the city?
No.
Can education be considered? Are you imitating good, or can you imitate knowledge?
Well, that's a good question. And in fact, that's the next question. So first of all, there's imitation in the city, because when you're learning a craft, you're really imitating.
But
first of all, you're not imitating to become an imitator. You're imitating to become a carpenter. The imitation is not your nature, it's the way into your nature. Okay, but there is another form of imitation in the city. What's that form of imitation? John?
Poetry.
Yeah, there is some amount of poetry, because, again, poetry is educational. Imitation is for the sake of education. So, well, we don't want to be making up poems all the time, but we'll take some passages from Homer, get rid of all the random stuff, and use them so that our young people can learn them and come to have a certain name. And what's the nature that we want them to have?
Garden. Courageous.
Moderate.
Courage. We want them to have courage. We want them to have moderation.
And philosophic.
Philosophic, that's a good...
Wisdom.
Wisdom is something we want too, but it's not clear. Can you get wisdom from imitating?
No.
Not clear that you can get wisdom. And justice, but we can't talk about that yet, apparently. We want our citizens to imitate in a way that will make them more virtuous. Well, how is imitating poems going to make you more virtuous?
Because
Well, there's the words. And what are we going to say about the words? The people in the poems have to be virtuous, and they have to be doing virtuous things. So that when we think about Achilles, the hero of the Iliad, we think, man, he was really, he was very moderate in his desires. That's a joke. Achilles wasn't very moderate. But we're going to cut out all those passages. We want the heroes that our youthful citizens are looking up to be good role models. Virtuous people doing virtuous things. And then at the same time, we want the modes and the rhythms of these poems to be appropriate. Well, modes and... How are modes and rhythms going to help us? Yeah?
I think you don't want the poet to take on the persona of the person who's telling the story about.
Okay, we don't want the poet...
Imitator.
We don't want the poet to be an imitator. Maybe sometimes if the person he's imitating is a virtuous person behaving virtuously, then he can imitate that because, well, we want him to be that. And if he is that, it won't be an imitation. He'll just be being himself. Oh. But what about rhythm?
Is it because that shows him, gives him a sort of sense of like order?
Yeah, well, our virtue in the city is a type of order. And the virtue we want, the moderation especially that we want in our citizen souls is, there's my pitch of the soul again, it's all the parts of the soul functioning harmoniously. Right? Well, harmoniously? Just saying it like that sort of clues us into what Plato's thinking. Having the appropriate harmonies sung to you is going to allow you to imitate harmony. But not if you imitate a bunch of different harmonies. Two harmonies played on top of each other are not harmonious. They're dissonant. So what do we need to do? We need to find the harmonies and the rhythms and modes that fit the stories about virtuous people behaving virtuously. And then we need to sing those to our children, and our children will, without even knowing it, without even realizing what harmony and moderation are, will become more harmonious and more moderate. So that when we explain to them, if we ever explain to them what moderation and harmony are, they will already be in harmony with moderation and take to it as something that belongs to them. But it's only going to work, first of all, if we pick a good harmony for our songs, and second of all, most importantly, pick a single harmony for all of our songs. We can't have a bunch of different harmonies. A bunch of different harmonies is dissonant. Isn't the coffee yet? It probably sounds something like this. You guys can move forward if you can't hear. Sorry. This is...
I don't think anything's going to help that.
Yeah? Can you hear me?
Just barely.
And coming in and out? Try to yell at the... Jackhammering.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of anything better to distract us than a jackhammer. Okay, are people with me? Oh, the imitation is—it's all connected. It's connected in all sorts of interesting ways to the one person, one job, or one person, one nature. First of all, imitation isn't a nature; it's at best a way into nature. And second of all, the person whose soul is harmonized is the person who is directed towards a which is unified around one principle. If your soul is in harmony, then you can do one job instead of needing to do a bunch of different jobs. Okay, let's see here. Page 95. 401, just below D. Just read this passage so that you know that I'm not making this up. Graham said all this last time, too. So at least if I'm making it up, we're going to make it up. But we're not. Here it is. Isn't it for the sake of these consequences, Glaucon, I said, that nourishment on music is of supreme importance? Everybody with me? Aren't rhythm and harmony infused to the greatest possible extent into the inward part of the soul, and don't they take hold of it most vigorously with the gracefulness they bring, and make it graceful if one nourishes it rightly, or the opposite if one doesn't? And wouldn't the person who's been nourished as one ought to be in that area also have the most acute perception of things left inadequate and not beautifully crafted or not formed beautifully by nature? And from having a rightful disdain for them, wouldn't he appreciate beautiful things and delight in them, and by admitting them into his soul, wouldn't he take nourishment from them and become gentle for them? And wouldn't the person nourished in that way rightly find fault with ugly things and hate them while he was still young, before having the power to grasp reason, so that when reason comes, he'll embrace it most eagerly, recognizing it by a feeling of kinship. The person whose soul is ordered has a certain kinship with beauty. Okay, well, that kind of came out of nowhere. What's the kinship with beauty all about?
Order.
What's that?
Order.
Okay, keep going. Why is beauty order?
Because order. It's sort of the same concept.
The work of art, and art means what we think of as art and also the work of crafts. The work of a craft is beautiful if all of its parts function together properly for some purpose. That's what made the pruning knife a good, virtuous pruning knife. It's also what makes it beautiful. The pruning knife is beautiful if its parts function together properly for the sake of some end. The person whose soul has parts that function properly for the sake of some end is the person who will most easily recognize when other things, other people, are made or done well. It's going to be a common recurring theme. Is there a hand somewhere?
Okay.
That's an excellent question. That's a good question.
It seems like justice is beautiful.
Is justice beautiful? Is beauty just?
It seems like
same.
They participate in each other.
In a way? Well, that's a good question.
You can sort of ask the same thing about good, though, too.
Good would be right in there. Moderation, maybe.
All forms hold together in one big
circle. I don't know. Can you be good without being beautiful? Good question.
Socrates would probably think so.
Okay, let's read the bottom of the page here, 402C. Before the gods, then, is it the way I'm saying that we're not going to be musically literate, and neither are those whom we claim need to be educated by us as guardians, before we recognize the look of moderation? Look is, it really should be form. The form of moderation and of courage and generosity, in greatness of manner and all their near kin, and also their opposites, everywhere they pass around us, and notice their presence in the things they're found in, both they themselves and their images, and not look down on them in either small or large instances, but consider them to belong to the same art for endeavor. Okay, so that's the purpose of poetry, is the harmonizing of the soul, so that even if we don't know why something is good, we can recognize that it is good. And that's exactly what he said from the beginning. It's a falsehood in words, because poetry is false. How do we know poetry is false? It's always false. It's an imitation. Imitations are false. It's a falsehood in words that engenders a truth in the soul. Even though I don't know why I want to be like Achilles, or what makes Achilles, I don't understand what makes Achilles virtuous, I come to possess the virtue that Achilles has by imitating Achilles and having my soul be harmonized in the way that Achilles' soul is harmonized. And that's interesting, that you can get these virtues without even knowing what they are, if you live in a state where you're educated to become virtuous. Okay. The next topic that Socrates needs to talk about is gymnastic exercise. And something interesting happens there's really two important parts of the discussion. The first is somewhat surprising. What's surprising about gymnastic exercise? What did we think was going to be true about it, and what turned out to be the case about it? What is gymnastics for? What's the point of gymnastics?
I'm not sure.
Claire?
Is it supposed to be the part that you're fierce and mean? I don't know how else to say it. It's the opposite of being gentle, whatever.
The opposite of being gentle. So why do we need something that's going to make us the opposite of gentle?
Fight the enemies to guard the city.
The most important people that we're educating here, more than any of the others, are who? The soldiers. And the soldiers, their education, we've said from the beginning, has to have a dual component. It has to be. It seems like a contradiction in their education. We have to make them fierce and gentle at the same time. Well, what's going to make them gentle?
Poetry.
You read a lot of poetry and your soul becomes harmonious and you become gentle. And too much of that stuff has a risk of making you kind of, well, a sissy. But we don't want our soldiers to be like that. We want them to be... They have to be aggressive, because they're going to have to defend us against our enemies. So we're going to need for them to be trained physically as well as intellectually. But what's so surprising about this physical training is that it's not just going to make them strong and able to do well in battle.
It orders their soul.
It's part of their soul's order. Why is that? What's that?
What makes their body working properly? Their body's not working properly, their mind can't work properly.
Okay, it's going to make their bodies work properly, and that's important. We'll come back to that in a second. And that's why we thought physical training was important. It's for the body. But even more than for the body, physical training is something that is directly for the soul. Because it's going to make them aggressive. If they have too much poetry and not enough of this gymnastics, they're not going to be balanced. They're going to be too soft. So we got to throw in some physical training here. But if they have too much physical training, they're going to be too aggressive and they're not going to be gentle enough, and that's no good either. We need, again, sort of strange the way the terms sort of fold on themselves. We need to harmonize the harmonizing and the physical training. so that these soldiers are, they're not like moping around listening to Nick Drake all the time. Everybody knows who Nick Drake is. And they're not, you know, spending all their time talking about the football game this weekend. We don't want meatheads and we don't want sissies, to put it in ridiculously superficial terms. We want people that are balanced to be our soldiers. Because we need them to be sensitive to the needs of our citizens, and we also need them to be strong and aggressive towards our enemies. So gymnastics is for the sake of control, even more than for the body. However, it's also for the body, and it's for the body for almost the exact reason that Kayla suggested. Why do we need our bodies to be strong? Well, we need our soldiers' bodies to be strong so that they can fight our enemies. But even more than that,
it's like sort of a physical type of justice. Everything that you need to be properly.
Why does your body need to be working together properly? Why can't you just sit there and have an orgasm? Okay, you can't learn and listen to poetry and music, but we don't want our soldiers to be listening to poetry and music. That's just so that they can become soldiers. Right? The imitation is always a means to an end. Okay, I'll go read the passage here. This is on page 400. This is 406. He's talking about, this is the first look at doctors. When a carpenter is sick, I said, he expects to swallow medicine from the doctor in order to heave up the disease or be purged of it below, or to suffer burning or cutting to get rid of it. Slightly different medicine. But if anyone prescribes a long course of treatment for him, putting clothes on his head and the things that go with them, he says without hesitation that he has no leisure to be sick and that it's not profitable to live that, keeping one's attention on a disease while neglecting his appointed work. After that, he says goodbye to that sort of doctor, steps back into his accustomed routine, gets healthy, and lives doing the things that belong to him. But if his body isn't adequate to bear up, he's set free from troubles by dying. For that sort of person, anyway, he said, it does seem appropriate to use the medical art that way. Is that because he has some work to do, I said, and if he couldn't do it, living was not a problem. Clearly, he said. Okay. Why is physical health important for the soul?
It helps you to do what you're supposed to do. So you be your virtue.
It allows you to, fulfill your nature.
To do your work. Which is to fulfill your nature.
And if you weren't able to fulfill your nature, then your soul would not be ordered.
Oh, okay, that's the part I want to know about, Chelsea. That's the next step. I can see why, if we're one of these, fulfilling our nature is good. Because fulfilling our nature allows us to function as an ordered part of the state as a whole. But Socrates is sneaking in something a little bit different. What's his point? If we're one of these, if we're the big circle, if you're the carpenter or the doctor or the shepherd, you want to be able to function properly as a whole, because if you don't, life isn't worth living for you. But wait a minute. Hasn't this guy read book one? The functioning of the whole, in the case of a craftsperson, is good for something else. Didn't we say that at the beginning? Isn't that how Thrasymachus was defeated in argument? Thrasymachus thought that craftspeople benefit themselves by performing their craft. But now Socrates seems to be assuming that the craftsperson is doing exactly what Thrasymachus was saying. In being a good carpenter, you are somehow benefiting yourself. Well, how's that? Well, that's not what he says. He says that if you can't do your work, your life isn't worth living. Not because you don't have enough money.
Just ordering your soul.
How's that?
It takes away, it destroys one part of your soul, but not destroys it. It doesn't allow all parts of your soul to function.
Well, why not? You can have a functioning soul without being a carpenter, can't you? I hope so. Anybody who's ever seen any bookshelves that I've made hopes so for me.
But you have to have some sort of work nature or something like that in order for your soul to be ordered. It's like the pruning knife. You have to have a purpose that those parts of you are working towards.
You have to have, if you want to order anything, what do you have to know about that thing? What's that, Luke?
What its nature is.
What it does. You got to know the end, right? The thing is ordered around its end. So we've got a carpenter, and the carpenter's end is carpentry. Doing the work of carpentry. And now, he has a function to order his life and his soul around. And when he asks himself, should I have that extra piece of cheesecake? He has a way of answering the question. And any question he asks himself about the way he should live his life, he can answer the question. He can organize and harmonize his soul and his desires around his work, around his function. And if you take away that function, he no longer has anything to order himself around. And if he doesn't have anything to order himself around, well, he can't order himself. Yeah, Chelsea?
So is that like saying, with the example of carpentry, if a carpenter lost his arm and he couldn't perform his task anymore, then he's just better off dead?
If he couldn't perform his task anymore, Socrates is saying his life is no longer worth living.
If his sole purpose was carpentry, right?
Right.
So wouldn't that be an
argument? And what do we know about his sole purpose? Each person has one nature, so it is carpentry. This is a very different view of life from the one we're used to. What's the meaning of life for these people?
Their work.
And if you can no longer fulfill your work, you no longer have a meaning for your life. Yeah?
I don't understand how this overcomes the problem of one. And the idea that justice was something that was worth living for, but it existed within your soul, not necessarily outside of it. It was like your goal, but also, I don't get how this doesn't contradict that stuff.
Yeah, let's see if we can get to the contradiction a little bit. See if we can make it a little bit worse. That's terrible. Well, we've got the same account of justice. Even though we don't know what justice is yet, we still have this ordering of the soul thing going on here. But our carpenter has an external end. Well, what do we know about things that have external ends? The end is unjust. It's not part of the order, and if it were to become part of the order, the whole thing would fall apart. Uh-oh. What's going on here? How do we save the carpenter? Or put it in another way here, what's the difference between a carpenter and a band of thieves? Yep. Caleb? No. No difference?
So the carpenter is like one of those small circles within a big circle of justice is working together with the other parts of the larger whole.
We need to draw a bigger circle around. The end would be just in the city, in the larger circle of the city.
The end of the carpenter, carpenter's really over here, right? And he's got, he or she has parts in his or her soul that are being ordered around the function of carpentry. And that function is going outside of the carpenter as a part of the larger function of the state. And then what's happening? Well, the farmer and the house builder, everybody else is working for everyone else in the state. So although the carpenter's end is outside of himself, because it's internal to the state, and the state is providing for all the carpenter's needs, the end is coming back to the carpenter. The carpenter is making bookshelves and giving them to whoever needs bookshelves, and then in return, he is getting all of his needs taken care of, food and shelter and clothing, so that he can continue being a carpenter. Within the context of the state, the carpenter does have an external end to help the state as a whole. So in a way, we have really solved the problem of book one, in a way, except for one thing.
What's the end of the state?
We still don't know what this is. Now we need an end. We need an end for the state as a whole. And just to make sure we don't think we have any idea what's going on here, why are we talking about the state as a whole? Because it's an analogy for the soul. So, okay, the carpenter in the just state seems okay, as long as we can make sense of the just state as a whole. But making sense of the just state as a whole is as problematic as making sense of the soul as a whole was at the beginning. Well, at least the carpenter's happy. Yep?
Couldn't you just say,
you could say never mind. In fact, the carpenter, in a way, that's sort of the benefit that he gets. He doesn't have to worry about any of this stuff.
Can the infinite state be, this might be a comment, I guess, it's the farmland state for the parts of the state. So the end is for the parts.
Well, that's right, and it is a cop, and it's a cop-out. So we need to keep it being right and make it not be a cop-out. Right, it's right because the state has to be an end in itself, has to have an internal end. We saw that in book one. That's what Elise is worried about. But the problem with the internal end is that we already know what it is. It's the ordered functioning of the state. But we need a way to make sense of the ordered functioning of the state without giving it an external end. And until we do that, we're still copping out a little bit.
So even if it's external end, it is internal, then it's still an external end.
But what is the internal end?
The proper functioning of the state.
Yeah, but to get something to function properly, we have to order it around some end. We can say, look, we're ordering this thing around its ordering, but that doesn't mean anything. We need to know, just like the carpenter needs to know what to have for breakfast, and can only do so in terms of, well, what he has to do that day. When we're ordering the state, we can only do so in terms of what the state has to do that day. Yep.
I'm still trying to figure out how to word it.
Okay. Raise your hand again. Figure it out. All right. So we know why function is so important here, and we seem to have run back into the same problem, except that, well, one small benefit is that it's not a problem for anyone in the state insofar as they're in the state, which is kind of neat. And Socrates is good. He throws this out sort of offhand all the time, that, you know, none of these people are getting all of the happiness, but we shouldn't be too surprised if they're happiest just the way they are. And we can now see why he's saying that. Because the way they are, where they are, how they are, it's a situation in which they can order themselves around some function and not have that end
remain external to them. It comes back to them in virtue of being a part of the just state. Figured out?
Yeah.
Okay.
So couldn't you say that the end goal of the state is to function harmoniously for the sake of being able to continually function harmoniously?
That's what Owen wants to say. And that's right. But Rocky's going to complain that it's a cop-out.
How can you know how to function harmoniously if there isn't the only function harmoniously? You know, there's certain ways to function harmoniously if you're achieving something that you're talking about the part of it. To achieve functioning harmoniously, you have to function harmoniously. Is that possible to know?
You have to know what the function is before you can make it harmonious. So the pruning knife, I can get the pruning knife to function harmoniously because I know that its function is cutting grapevines. And I can order all of its parts so that it can do that function harmoniously, or beautifully, or justly, or virtuously, however we want to put it. Well, if I want the human being or the state to function harmoniously,
wouldn't the end goal be to be a just city?
But to be a just city just means to function harmoniously. So that's fine, but what's the function? The function is to function harmoniously. But I don't know how to get the harmony until I know what it is that the function is. Which means I'm still stuck with this question of the end. Even though I know that the end is the functioning harmoniously, I still need another end. We're just like pruning knives, except that we don't have an external end, which is what is so great about us and also so puzzling. Yeah?
It's just like you were saying how the person's end becomes internal because within the city, people help each other out within their specializations. Isn't that the same as like the city's end becoming internal because?
Well, for the city's end to become internal in the way that the carpenter's end becomes internal, what do we have to do with the city? We've got to put it in a larger context. But well, I mean we're just going to get. Everybody knows what an infinite regress is, right? We're just going to get a regress, because the larger circle is going to have to be so it's going to have to be in a larger circle, and then circles within circles. Which probably is the way the world works, but still, we still need to understand it. Yeah?
It seems like it should be sort of easy to ground this thing, just in plain and simple, like...
Go ahead, ground it.
What's the deal with it? That which causes things to die is bad. That which keeps things alive.
Yeah, actually Socrates tried that. He tried making it just be based on necessity.
And that's when they started talking about how there's no luxury.
Exactly. That was the city for pigs. The city for pigs was a city that worked that way. And Socrates really thought he could have talked about justice in that way. But by avoiding this problem, because Glaucon and Adamantus... He thought wouldn't notice, but Glaucon actually noticed. You could, an animal in the wild has a sort of a justice. All of its parts function together, and its desires are controlled. Have you ever seen a safari video of a really overweight lion? Probably not. Well, why not? What's going to happen to the lion if it gets overweight?
Can't catch up with its food.
It won't be able to catch up with its food, and then it's going to lose weight. In nature, things have they have external constraints placed on them. That's what the non-luxurious city was like. All the people did was meet their needs, and because they were just barely meeting their needs and struggling to meet their needs, they could order themselves around the meeting of needs. But here's the weird thing about a human being, why Glaucon was right that it's not actually a human city. We meet our needs pretty easily. And you, in your life, are not going to have a hard time meeting your needs. takes a very small fraction of your day. What do you do with the rest of the day? What do you do with yourself for the rest of the day? All your needs are met. You still got all that time to kill. What are you going to do with it? Well, prostitutes, pastries, those are all good options, but there might be a better option. You with me? So we can't just use needs. If we could, we wouldn't have to think about anything. Turn that around the other way. If all we had to do was meet needs, we wouldn't get to think about anything. We wouldn't have a chance. The lion, there are no lions have composed fifth symphonies. They rarely get past the third. Thank you very much. The 10 o'clock show is totally different. Okay, last part of book three here. We just need to get this in here. He talks about doctors and judges. And he makes an interesting distinction. First of all, the fewer the better for both of those. Because doctors are only necessary when the body is sick. And if we set up our state as well as we can, there will be less need for them because people will be more healthy. People will be able to fill their functions properly and there'll be less sickness. And sickness is something to be avoided. And judges, too, are just like doctors, except for one small difference. Where's the sickness that the judges wrestle with? In mind, or what's Plato's favorite word?
Soul.
Yeah. The judges are just like doctors, except they are healing the soul and not the body. When you go to a judge, at least in this state, in our state this unfortunately is not as true, when you go to a judge in Plato's Republic, you go there because you have a sickness in your soul, some sort of disorder. And what the judge is supposed to do, what the judge's punishment is supposed to do, is reorder your soul. And there's an interesting distinction here between the doctors and the judges. Anybody notice the distinction? It's near the end of book three.
Doctor doesn't use his own body to heal everybody, but the judge uses his own soul.
Yeah. So what does that mean? The doctor heals bodies, but she doesn't heal bodies with her body. She heals bodies with her soul. So the best doctor is the person that was really sick a lot when they were a child. Because they have first-hand experience of diseases. Well, we might think that the same would be true for a judge. The good judge is the person who was really vicious as a child. But that's not true. Why not? Okay, because the judge heals souls with their soul. But so what?
They can't have a corrupted soul or a damaged soul. Because they wouldn't be able to use it properly.
Why not? It seems like he could have just said, look, if the judge has a vicious soul, then like anybody with a vicious soul, they won't be able to do their function. But he says something else.
He's got to get knowledge of the wickedness later in life after his soul's already developed into a good one, so he's not corrupted by the soul.
Yeah.
When you're young, you're easily corrupted by the...
When you're young, you're easily corrupted. Something like that. Yeah, John?
It says vice can never know virtue in itself, but virtue knows by itself.
That's the point. That's the important point here. What does that mean? The judge who's virtuous is going to know both when somebody is virtuous and when somebody's vicious. Why? And the person that's vicious isn't going to know both. In fact, the person who's vicious isn't going to really know either. Go ahead. Yeah?
Is
keep going. Why does the virtuous person know both virtue and vice?
Yeah.
gives an example of the man who tries to be crafty and sneaky around people of his own type because he's ignorant. He doesn't trust.
Yeah, he doesn't trust people. But why does the person who's virtuous know virtue and vice? Don't you have to be virtuous to know virtue and be vicious to know vice? Wouldn't that make sense? Like knows like. A person who is vicious has a pattern of viciousness in their soul, and so they can identify viciousness, and the person who is virtuous has the pattern for virtue in their soul, so they can identify virtuousness. Doesn't that make sense? Best way to catch a thief is to be a good thief. Because you know how a thief thinks.
Isn't sort of like how justice is like itself and injustice is not like itself.
Could have something to do with that.
Vice is not like itself, but virtue is like itself. So if you know virtue, then you can recognize when something is not like virtue. But if you only know vice, which is not like itself to begin with, then you won't be able to tell.
I like the first part here. If you are vicious, that doesn't make you a pattern of viciousness, because there isn't a pattern of viciousness. Every viciousness is different. But how does the virtue know the viciousness?
Because it's stolen from it. It's not like virtue. If there's only one virtue, and you know that virtue, then everything else is vicious.
The virtue is the pattern. It's the pattern for everything. Just like health is the pattern for everything having to do with the body. The properly functioning body, knowing the properly functioning body is the knowledge of what makes a body function properly, and it's also going to be a knowledge of what causes a body to function improperly. Because both knowledges are of the pattern. And the improper functioning is just a lack of the pattern coming to be in the body. The judge is the same way. The judge, in being virtuous, has the pattern of virtue in their soul. But with one added sort of hitch here. What does it mean to have the pattern of virtue in your soul? It's not to have a knowledge in any way we usually think of having knowledge. It's not like the doctor who, there's the body and you can put it on a chart and you have knowledge of it. The pattern of virtue in the soul is being virtuous. You can't know it without being it. Because to know it is to have the pattern in your soul, but to have the pattern in your soul is to be it. The judge has to be virtuous to be a judge. That's the knowledge of virtue, being virtuous. And it's the sort of thing that you can have even unconsciously as a child and then come to develop. In fact, that's what the whole education system is designed to do. We want to give this person a pattern of virtue, so that they are akin to what's virtuous and they can identify it in themselves and in others when they come to be able to identify these things. It's pretty neat. There's a fine line here, maybe no line, between being virtuous and knowing what virtue is. Properly speaking, there's no distinction. But it seems like there's also some sort of distinction. The carpenter is not a judge, but the carpenter is virtuous. The judge is a judge, and therefore must be virtuous. Okay, I'll say a little bit more about that next time, and then you have papers to do, but we also have to keep moving forward here. I want people to read at least, if you can't get to the end of book four, at least through, about 440, to the end of the discussion of the division of the soul. Yeah, 442. Okay, good luck on the interviews.
I try to be really quick because I'm on my ride, so you can basically, I'm nervous about. I'm nervous about accidentally arguing against the conclusion because my.